and welcome to The Exploits of Play, a podcast about the strange and unexpected roles that games and play are playing in our stage of capitalism that just keeps getting weirder. My name is Max Haven, and I'm the Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination.
And I'm Hallie Frost from the platform Weird Economies, and we're presenting this podcast. Today, we'll speak to Gargi Bhattacharya, who lives and works in London as a professor of sociology at University of East London. She writes on issues of systemic injustice, racial capitalism, social reproduction, climate crisis, and collective survival. She's the author of Rethinking Racial Capitalism from 2018, Dangerous Brown Men from 2008, and Traffic from 2005. Max, can you introduce Gargi's work further for us?
I mean, I've known about Gargi's work for a long time, and it's some of the work that I go to first when I'm trying to understand the strange intersections of race and gender and capitalism in our moment. For a number of years, I was teaching her phenomenal book, Rethinking Racial Capitalism, Questions of Reproduction and Survival, which came out in 2018, and it provides a really cogent articulation of how all of these pieces fit together. And I really wanted to bring her on this podcast to ask about something that's been sort of pulling at the back of my mind for a while, which is the way that in the rise of the far right in the last decades has really circulated around this question of what I call the cheating other, this group that's imagined to be cheating the welfare system, cheating the immigration system, cheating the social benefits system, and otherwise somehow disrupting or destroying what is presented as an otherwise fair and just system of racial capitalism. Now, of course, this is usually a white supremacist fantasy that's mobilized by white supremacist political parties and political figures to insist that, in fact, they and they alone can help stop the cheaters and make the game of living under capitalism once again fair. But I wanted with Gargi to sort of get to the bottom of where the appeal of this idea of the cheating other and the racialized cheating other comes from. What's its history and how does it entangle itself in a moment of capitalism where everything feels like it's changing and in flux? Cast your mind back to childhood and a game that you remember playing that taught you something significant about life or the world or society.
I'm sure lots of the writers and scholars you've talked to have said this, but of course I was quite a solitary child, as book readers tend to be. How sad. So it seems very cruel to say, oh, how few friends did you have when you were little? We all say it to each other. So I also was a solitary lone player, in common with many others, meant that I had a very extensive imaginary world, that my play world was made in that interstices between a reality and a fantasy world where I found it quite hard to tell the difference, and a quite extensive way of talking about and thinking about myself in the present and in the future and as other kinds of being, and really practicing many different kinds of social relations and terms, kinds of embodiment that were not really, really available. What is real here? As many children did, like tried out being taller, shorter, differently gendered, differently racialized, different periods, different family makeups, different ways of being self-sufficient in the world. I was really interested in magic, but magic as a mode of self-sufficiency, as if like magic could be like, oh, you would always have enough, or you'd have the spell to have enough, or that you could quantify knowledge in a way that you would have enough. So I think some of the things I learned from those modes of play were both the kind of painful, hard realities of what magical thinking couldn't do, but at the same time, always keeping a door open to what magical thinking might and could do, which I guess is what brings us to where we are today.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So we're going to be talking today quite a bit about your new book, which just came out as we're recording this at the end of 2023, The Futures of Racial Capitalism, out from Polity. That book follows on your last book on racial capitalism. And in the beginning of this one, you sort of invite us to think about racial capitalism as a puzzle. And I was really struck by this metaphor because this podcast is about the exploits of play, the weaponization and de-weaponization of games. And I hadn't thought about the puzzle, but it's a really potent metaphor to think through something. And you talk a little bit in that introduction about, you know, searching for the pieces of this puzzle and feeling like the pieces never all quite come together. What does that metaphor offer you? And for those listeners who are probably familiar with the term racial and the term capitalism, but not necessarily so familiar with what happens when you put them together, what does that term do for us now?
I've started to think about the idea of racial capitalism as a puzzle, because I've been saying for quite some time, you know, as you say, from the other book I wrote about racial capitalism, that I tried to approach racial capitalism not as an endpoint theorization, but as a question. But, you know, the putting together of racial and capitalism for me, and I think the kinds of traditions that I'm working in and building on and feeding off, is much more about opening a question about why solidarity and class agency remain so elusive given the parallel class violences done in the name of capitalism and through capitalism, and yet dispersed amongst populations that have arbitrary divisions between them. And those arbitrary divisions can be made in different ways, sometimes with different names, but I'm using the term racial as a shorthand for what the arbitrary allocation of status and category might mean, only to suggest that some other social categorizations are less absolutely arbitrary than the racial, which has no referent at all. In terms of the puzzle, because I've been trying to think of racial capitalism as a question, not a final word theorization, I think a lot of people use that word, racial capitalism, that phrase, as if it's a new meta-theory that will finally nail the difficulties of Western Marxism on the head, and then we'll have kind of encompass what a worlded Marxism is. Rather than that, I prefer to think of it as a way of, oh, well, we're not yet there yet with freedom. And I'm trying to think of it as a puzzle because as it changes shape, I was finding it harder to narrate the whole, not easier. You know, I had some idea a few years ago, like, oh, at least if you look backwards, you can see here's some modes of production, here's some expansionist projects, here's some settler colonial projects, here's some technical innovations that remake global capital, put them together and you have some idea of where we get to a certain point. But because I was then trying to understand how we might see racial capitalism in movement, so not what has just passed, but what is happening and is just about to happen, the reason why the puzzle is a good metaphor is it disconcerts our habits of critique. That a lot of the left, including the left that I'm most engaged in and made from, thinks that you start to write and think and organize once you have mastered the object that you stand against and you stand in critique against it. That assumes all kinds of things about our ability to see the whole, to know what position we're taking. And it also transforms our political voice and approach into a kind of ethical moment. The puzzle says something different. The puzzle says, I can kind of see all the pieces, and I may or may not know that some of them are good or bad. But the thing I need to understand first is how the pieces are articulated against each other, because the politics has to come out of that understanding. I'm not sure if that is making sense, but that is why I've been knocking about with the idea of the puzzle. And I also think it makes us pay attention to each piece a little bit more, because to put together the pieces of a puzzle, you have to give some attention to every piece. And I think there's something useful about holding, of course we know, of course capital is always totalizing, we know all of that stuff, but to just hold back on those habitual forms of thinking as capital remakes itself slightly differently before us so that we can might comprehend the components. Because I feel like understanding the configuration of the components is necessary for our collective survival, for us to know where life could be. That's really what I think.
In the book, some of the components that appear are prisons and the kind of the new techno-carceral archipelago around the world, and borders and debt, and also platforms. This new age of digital platforms, what some have called platform capitalism. And I wanted to focus in on that last one because it's perhaps the most relevant to our discussion about play and games. Yeah, I mean, we've seen over the last few years a variety of really interesting publications that try and understand what's happened now that big tech, in partnership with high finance, has created these technologies that now seem like such a huge part of our life, and how the world is organized and how capitalism is organizing itself. But we haven't seen, I think, as much a kind of systematic understanding of how race and racialization play into those platforms. And I feel you do some really important work in the book, and I wonder if you could just sort of summarize that.
I mean, I have a few things I think are worth for us to say to each other. One is that I'm not persuaded readily that platform capitalism simply reconstructs the racialized landscapes that we already have and know from the last few phases of global capital's technological developments have been. So I think there's at least a melding together of an existing landscape of inequality, which includes the sedimented dispossession that is our, you know, the racialized history of capitalism, and at the same time, an odd opening of opportunity and shaking up that can remake racialized landscapes. So I kind of haven't got much further than that, but those two things together need to be understood and left open. At least one of the ways in which that happens, which people who have done, all kinds of people that have been doing work around working across within the platform economy have been talking about, is the awkward but significant way in which platform corporations, in what I suspect is still their early formation, because we're seeing, these are quite rapid changes that are happening, and in many ways we're quite early in, the articulations of what this might mean for the corporate form more generally across many different sectors. We're starting to see that movement happening, but I certainly can't articulate it yet. But certainly in the earlier phases around the kind of melding of what I would summarize as following others as the move of the kind of logistical elements of capital, of commodity distribution and commodity transportation and commodity storage. All of those things are things that the big global platforms have been playing with. But in those kinds of work, the kind of work, non-work that emerges, migrant workers across all the global locations where people are mapping it are significantly overrepresented within this new workforce. And it is a horrible new workforce. And as with all of these moments when capital remakes itself and goes to a bit of a technological leap, there's nothing fun about being in the workforce that is included, except it's better to be included than not included, if not included means to be abandoned and to be in the spaces where even the most minimal access to the means of life is being taken out of those spaces. So that, I think, is a clue of that component of the puzzle, that on the one hand, platform corporations squat within the pre-existing dispossession of those who cannot enter the formal labour market easily, who might already have been multiply displaced because of both economic and climate and political kind of pushes, and that they become the kind of first innovation workers of a very rapidly emerging corporate form. And they are hugely overexploited in ways that are also innovative in the most ugly of ways, or the ways that the refusal of the employment relation has become a corporate tactic across the world. You know, that's a trick of this new reformation. And yet they are also the people who are entering work in large numbers, often multiple forms of work, because one form of connection with a corporation is often not enough to sustain life, at the same time as parallel populations or parallel spaces are falling out of anything that looks like work at all. And that's a kind of shifting around of the patterns of racialization and economic activity.
I was going to bring up an example and see what you think about it, because so for these last few years, I've been running a research project, activist research project called Worker as Futurist, where we've been supporting rank and file Amazon workers, mostly in North America, to write speculative fiction about the world after Amazon. So these are mostly warehouse workers, pickers in the warehouses and distribution centers and fulfillment centers, drivers, but also some other people you might not expect to be working for Amazon, like people working on the MTurk platform, which is this micro task platform where you basically go on and you bid against other workers to do like tiny micro tasks that take seconds for like basically pennies. And this is the way that a lot of artificial intelligence data sets are developed. Big data, how it's kind of cleansed so that the computer can read it. And there's also other people who are like sellers on Amazon, like they're their own independent business people using the Amazon system. So basically, we limited ourselves to people whose wages are dependent on Amazon. And it was really, really interesting. And I think your book really helped shed some light on thinking through both the conditions under which these people worked and also their dispositions and their thinking about capitalism and about race and racialization. Because, of course, almost all of our participants are from racialized backgrounds. That is who Amazon's like rank and file workforce is. Most people are from migrant backgrounds, either having themselves migrated to Canada, the United States, or their parents. And many of them are also living in suburbs or exurbs, you know, where Amazon, as Charmaine Chua points out in her work, that's like sort of where Amazon is recruiting a lot of people, in part because people there are, you know, they need work because those areas have been denuded of a lot of forms of employment. But also because in various ways that Charmaine points out in her work, it makes the population a bit more exploitable. They're very busy. They have kids. They're driving long distance or using public transportation to go long distances. And for various ways, this actually makes this workforce more exploitable by Amazon and more disposable by Amazon. So your writing had me thinking about this because these are also often spaces, these exurbs, that are associated with the kind of decay of white America and the left behinds, as they've been sort of framed somewhat problematically by sociologists. And just thinking about how in these terrains around these distribution centers, you have all of this complexity play out as capitalism reconfigures itself and conscripts various types of bodies into its apparatuses and different forms of racialization, and how racialization changes in that mix as well.
No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that's almost one of the exemplary examples. I think Amazon's activity is one of the exemplary examples for all the reasons you say. But what I think is often not said, that is implied both in what you've said and in what I've said, is that although, of course, Amazon operates a whole business model that relies almost explicitly on the sedimented outcomes of racialized dispossession, as you say, why some people are geographically and socially and economically located in such a place that, you know, all of this rubbishy work is an offer, and an offer that really cannot be refused for enough of them. I think there's something useful to thinking that we don't know yet what that means in terms of the politics of race. That when we've talked about, and we the left, the global left, have talked in previous generations about the hyper-exploitation of the racially subordinated and or migrant workforce. That has always been implicitly and often explicitly in comparison to a mainstream workforce who may be racially privileged and or caste privileged or geographically privileged. Implied within those forms of privilege are a certain form of infrastructural privilege, of, you know, residential privilege with a whole set of amenities attached to that, whether provided through the company wage or the social wage. What I think is in such rapid flux that it's almost impossible for us to see is the absolute disintegration of that implied centre along from which the subordinated labour force is meant to take its meaning as less than. So it is not clear to me what happens then. That doesn't mean that we move into some post-racial future or that some great things happen. It just means that, once again, capital finds new ways to fuck us. That's what accumulation means, isn't it? That just as we find ways of semi-reforms and to organise ourselves, capital's innovation will find ways to immiserate us some more. It's not about being kind or unkind. It's within the logic of accumulation. What can I take from? The workforce is one of the things I can take from. Not the only one, but it's one of the places I must take from. So I just kind of think it's helpful for us as people of goodwill who would like us to live in a survivable planet and live decent lives, to think, well, racism can change, or the work that racism does for capital can change. And that even as we maintain our critical purchase on what has just happened about the poor quality of work, the refusal to admit that this is waged work, and the kind of erasure of working conditions, we should also be alert to the ways in which the Amazons of the world are remaking everyone's working and living life, and perhaps positioning us in ways that we cannot yet imagine in terms of the politics of race. I just don't know. I mean, it's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know. I don't, what will happen when racialized bodies do the rubbishy work, but there's nothing but the rubbishy work? Which is a world that, you know, I think in many locations we are already very close to. You know, I think then kind of a lot of bets are off, and we need to think how we both retain our anti-racist critique of local and global politics while also understanding what differential entitlement through the world of work and beyond means. None of which is happy, but it's kind of important.
One of the siren songs of this phase of capitalism that is associated with the rise of platforms. And I'm thinking here like platforms like Uber, let's say, or even Instagram or TikTok, is that anyone can use these platforms to get ahead. You know, that you too can be a player, to use part of the terminology that we keep circling back to in this podcast, that, you know, there was always the myth since the 70s that the neoliberal revolution would have a revolution, would sort of be the rising tide that would lift all boats, that it was going to be the world of opportunity. And then since the 90s and capitalist globalization, we had this whole mythology that's, you know, now there was nothing preventing extremely poor person in, a poor country from competing toe-to-toe with Bill Gates to build the next computer system or some, you know, nonsense like this. But now with these rise of these platforms, that's gone from common sense to gospel truth that, you know. And one of the things I noticed with the Amazon workers is a lot of people sort of believe this, that there was a kind of a new meritocracy of some sort being brought about. And people, when we would talk about the intersections of race and capitalism, many of our participants would sort of say, well, like that might have been true at one point, that there were these systemic barriers. But now you have only to, you know, have a little bit of talent and a competitive spirit. And, you know, especially for people, you know, in their 20s, you could become an influencer. You could rise up from, you know, being an Uber driver into some, or you know, driving, doing food delivery to some other plateau. What do you make of this? Is this just like the democratization of false consciousness, like the democratization of a kind of normative bourgeois idea? Or I sense that there might be something else going on too about people's strange optimism in this moment, that somehow capitalism is giving people the opportunity to transcend former racial barriers.
It's odd, isn't it? Because I think people can think more than one thing at once. So I do think that there's something about a kind of disruption and unpredictability around racialized barriers, which echoes what I've just said. And I think that there is something in that, not that racism is receding, but just passing terms of a quite relatively, you know, static racial order, very much tied to particular, in particular places, to a racial state, to a castal system, to a moment when the national state is far more cleanly and overtly tied to a mode of capital, which itself had a kind of national or sometimes national affiliation, you know, at least, you know, even when capital is moving, it, you know, it's had its favoured spaces. Whereas now a lot of things are much more it's uncertain. You know, it's part, if you start to make it uncertain for the affluent workers of two generations ago, which is really what we're seeing everywhere, then some of the things about racialized barriers have also become uncertain, because that was what the barrier was between, are you going to be a racially subordinated class so we can make the pretended sense of the affluent working class or the lower middle class make sense? And I think all of that is in flux. But whether people truly believe that capital can save us, can give us any of us the good life, is sustainable, I think that's very variably thought, and that, you know, I haven't been doing big field work on this, but just around different things you read and people you know, I just think the idea that capital is killing us all and killing itself, it is kind of part of the zeitgeist in many locations, and very much thought by younger people. In those ways, I think older people might be still enthralled to the pretense that capital can fix itself. And I think the generational divide in terms of attitudes to climate crisis is an indication of that. The difference between people under 40 who think, well, obviously we're going to die very soon because a lot of people are already dying, and people who kind of act like you can just carry on business as normal because capital wouldn't let us die. But, you know, that's a straightforward generational divide around when people were socialized into capitalist living. Those differences happen at the same time, but I think they might be co-constitutive, that the disruption of previous racialized orders, which belong to a moment of global capitalism, that thought that at least in some parts of the world, there could be an ordering of social space for the interests of capital using the local state as its machinations, and a moment where all bets are off around most of that. For most of the world, some bits of Europe I know are holding on, certainly not Britain, but some other European, you know, mainly that game seems to me to be over. And that means that those racial categorizations and statuses are very much in flux, at the same time as capitalist self-immolation is ever nearer. And I think a lot of people are kind of think both those things at the same time.
I want to drill down into that feeling that emerges from holding those contradictory ideas at the same time, which, you know, I think we all hold those two contradictory feelings at the same time in a funny way, which is the idea of cheating and being cheated. And there's a number of different components of this I want to talk through with you. But the beginning, I think, is what works and what doesn't work about sort of the approaches that say that, like, the formerly sort of privileged, those who feel their privilege slipping away as racial subjects, that they feel sort of cheated by this system, and that they're sort of on the lookout for who cheated them. You know, this is an argument that, for instance, gets made kind of in Arlie Hochschild's Strangers in Their Own Land, where she sort of like, she likens the plight of whites, working class people in Louisiana in the United States, to feeling like they've been cheated out of something that they were entitled to. And she's very sympathetic to these subjects. I mean, critical on the left, but, you know, yeah, what do you make of that discourse?
It is politically tricky, isn't it? Because on the whole, subjects who feel able to articulate a sense of being cheated by the promise of capitalism are those who've held some arbitrary privilege, largely on the basis of someone else's arbitrary disprivilege in recent times. I don't know another way of telling that story. That doesn't mean that people's sense of disappointment and having something they hoped for and had seen recent generations of their community enjoy, you know, their disappointment in not having that isn't genuine and to be recognised. But it's tricky, isn't it, when most of the world has never enjoyed those things and nor expected them. What happens when we think of that as having been cheated, and what would have to happen for that sense of being cheated instead to be transformed into a consciousness of having joined the mass of humanity, and what could be done if people found ways to understand themselves as at last, if a little belatedly, joining the human condition rather than being in a suspended state of pretended protection, which is so very brief. I mean, I know, of course, we have a similar discourse and experience in Britain, but it was such a brief amount of time in which broadly white working class communities, through actually hard class war and the concessions that were won through hard class war, plus the disruption of major military disruption across the world and the remaking of national economies through that, but those things together bought actually only a number of decades of quite rapid material gain for communities who had very much not enjoyed national wealth in those ways, not being part of the distribution of national wealth. But it was an unusual experience. It's a globally unusual experience and a historically unusual experience for those communities who enjoyed in Europe, the welfarist moment. I don't know what you'd call it in North America, but certainly the moment of the post-war social contract in which some kind of sharing of the goodies of being part of the industrial high point of the world with working communities happened. But only happened, when did it happen? 40s are still very, very hard, maybe from the mid-50s until, when we say, to the 73 oil crisis. Probably that is the period, isn't it? Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't take that, the wins of that, as real wins that we use to articulate what we all want. I think there's still important things about the social wage to talk about, but we also all need to say to each other, okay, let's be honest about the factors that allowed those wins for that section of the global population in that moment, because we will never replicate the things that we miss and feel cheated out of unless we come to have some upfrontness and honesty about that. I guess the other thing I was going to say, and I don't know if how much this is the case for North America, and I only feel it, I live in London now, and London is very different from the rest of Britain. And I lived in the Midlands, in Birmingham, and I grew up in Leicester, and I lived in Birmingham for 20 plus years, 22 or 23 years, which is a very different feeling, a different kind of deindustrialized moment within Britain. But I have much less sense that younger British people who are racialized as white are invested in their whiteness in the way that people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s were. In my youth, that marker of whiteness was very important to my peers. I do not get that sense from younger white people. And I say this partly anecdotally, but partly the breakdowns that were done around the Corbyn moment. I mean, it's well known that if you had done a general election, which was people under 24, the Corbyn Labour Party would have won every seat. That tells you something about those racialized identifications and the markers around internationalism, around foreign policy, around what a reckoning of the colonial past of. And that's also what I mean about that disruption about the racialized order. Because what is the former racialized order giving to younger white, so-called white people? Less and less, if anything, I think. And I think, well, we have to both recognize that, but think of it as, well, what kind of opportunity is that for us, for our side? Because in my generation, it was very hard to think of how you would bring white people of my age around to a truly internationalist class politics, because the payoffs of the white wages of whiteness were such that they're always being pulled in these two directions. No, in a moment, what are the wages of whiteness if you're 22? I'm damned if I know. I can't see anything that they're getting that was promised. And they know that. And I think you see, in the numbers of young people out in the streets of Palestine. I think you see it in the numbers of young people who, of all ethnicities, who flocked to the global movement for Black Lives because they understood what state violence meant, even if it wasn't the state violence they necessarily faced. So I think like all of that is like, it's our job to clock it in a way that is not only nostalgic.
I want to come back to this question about young people, and particularly because it's a very, that generation that's emerging now into politics is a very gameful and playful generation. But I'll come back to that in a second. I want to continue just with this question of the cheat and the fear of the cheat, because one of the things that I'm trying to puzzle through and we're trying to puzzle through in the podcast is, on the one hand, you have a kind of new breed of clownish far-right politicians who seem to have made incredible political mileage by accusing mostly racialized groups of being cheaters. You know, these are the people who are claiming welfare or benefits, or presumed to be claiming welfare and benefits, who are assumed to be cheating the system, or migrants at the border or crossing borders who are assumed to be cheating the border regime, or all sorts of actors who are sort of vaguely racialized in their figuration within the popular depiction as somehow being cheating the social contract, with the implication that the normative subject being addressed by these far-right people, these far-right actors, they never cheat. You know, that they never, you know, these are the people who play by the rules, and people who play by the rules are being cheated out of their, birthright or out of their privileges by this kind of cheating other. I'm trying to hold that in my mind at the same time as this new breed of far-right politicians are objectively and often quite nakedly cheats themselves. I mean, I think Trump is perhaps the most self-evident, someone who actually takes pride in, you know, not being a chump and not following the rules when he doesn't have to. But even the kind of clown car of the British Conservative Party, these are full of people who cheated many times. They cheated on their taxes, cheated on, you know, rules governing if they're allowed to invest, you know, insider trading stuff. I mean, it's quite shocking and not particularly well hidden either. What do you make of this? That, you know, you have these, you know, corporations. We had the LIBOR scandal was just one incredible act of cheating by big banks and corporations. It no longer comes as a surprise when the cheating is revealed. And yet somehow these forces seem to have so much power to point the finger along these racialized lines and say, no, the cheaters are over there. What do you make of it?
Well, in Britain, I think that the real open kleptocracy of both major parties actually now is part of a real rapid downward spiral of all institutionals imploding. Although I'm always aware that I speak of, Britain is going through its own particular difficulties, which a very rapid remaking of the institutional landscape, a kind of throwing away of any checks and balances. Whereas, as you say, the spectre of the proud and self-proclaimed cheat across the global right it's a bigger historical phenomenon, and I'm not altogether sure what is going on with that. I mean, again, even within my lifetime, it would have been a very large political scandal for some of the things that members of the current Tory government or the current shadow cabinet in Britain or Trump or all kinds of global political figures have done and been shown to have done and kind of just put up their hands like that to have done. There would have at least been some consequences for their political career, even if they had never, you know, paid with prison time, which might be what someone poorer might have had to do. No, there's no consequence at all, and it's very hard to process what that means, a complete abandonment of even a pretense of accountability. I do think that something about the institutionalisation of anti-politics, so that we're supposed to, with others, in Empire's Endgame, in the collectively written book that I was part of, we tried to understand that figure of buffoonishness, that, you know, to just a display of political power as buffoonish, as dishevelled, as untrustworthy, as precisely the political offer, not as something to be hidden, not behind the political offer. The political offer is of the buffoon. And it's something that I think really feeds into people's sense of disempowerment, but also kind of an odd self-defeating sense of superiority amongst the electorate, as if that we will never be as low as them. Oh, they are all the same. And that people love Boris Johnson in Britain, but they admit that he's a fool and a liar and possibly an abuser and things. But they still kind of, and I think around the time people were saying similar things about Trump, but at least it's out in the open. The idea is that anyone who seeks political office is this kind of figure. I'm less a fool to be able to see who is that, rather than the kind of double disappointment of those who pretend to be something other than that and are still that. I do think that it's a dangerous moment, and it's a dangerous moment not because the electoral process works for all of those struggling to stay alive, but because the absolute hollowing out of democratic institutions, whatever minimal impact they're meant to have, leaves us with this kind of free-for-all, which accompanies this corporate free-for-all in which the whole landscape of who can live, who can die, who is to be punished, who is not to be punished, is kind of all up for grabs in flux without a clear idea of who has any authority to order our lives in a way that we might just all not, you know, collapse into nothingness. I don't understand how this has happened so quickly in my lifetime, really. And it was still, even in the 80s, even with the rise of the new right, I think there was still quite a lot of public discourse that was trying to hold to account. It feels that as the 21st century has proceeded, we've moved away from that across the world, and that, you know, we can see in the kind of hollowing out of journalism. You know, what's the point of being a critical journalist now? Because there's, who are you speaking to? What is all these things? I think, you know, that on a better day, I think they're part of this rapid reformulation. That one of the things that our side must also learn then is what it would be to recognise where the sites of political power are, and to find some techniques to hold them to account. Because clearly, what we are having, you know, we just have an empty theatre on all sides at present. And I also think people, lots of electorates know that, and it's, of course, built into the anti-politics, the neoliberal moment that's just passing. So, okay, all of you lot run away, because whoever you vote for, the government always wins, and the government always hates you, and the government always loves capital, and capital hates you. So, they, you know, we've all been, you know, properly kicked in the head to understand that in the last 30 years. We probably cannot carry on like that, and different ways of experiments in populist politics, experiments in horizontalist politics, experiments in a new municipalism. These are all, I think, the indications that many people in the world think, oh, we can't carry on like this. You know, what would it mean to remake politics in our moment?
Well, let's then return maybe to the younger generations and their sentiments, because I think you're absolutely right. I mean, around the world, opinion polls on almost every issue are starkly divided by age, and it's quite shocking. I was just looking at recent opinion polls in the United States around support for Palestinian human rights, and it's just, I mean, the gulf is massive, and the gulf is actually more consequential by age than it is by political affiliation. So young people, even on the right, what matters more is your age than than where you say you stand on the political spectrum. As decrepit and ridiculous as the political spectrum presents itself in the United States these days, it's an interesting set of statistics. And I guess I want to come back to this question of young people through something that you mentioned at the end of your book, which is about laughter and jokes, which I think is an amazing way to end a book on the futures of racial capitalism. It's not the way anyone would expect you to end the book, given that it's, you know, there's not a lot to laugh about. But I think you sort of want to close that book on the question of pleasure and the ambiguities of pleasure, and also laughter as somehow a platform for collective liberation. But I think to get there, first I want to just note and ask you to think with us a little bit about then what I think a lot of people would imagine if you talked about race and laughter, which is kind of the kind of sadistic humor that has reared its head again in this moment of sort of, you know, comedians who claim that they're being censored for, you know, their racist jokes and sexist jokes and this sort of thing. And the great success that the right has had with memes and with kind of mockery, you know, to go back to Trump again, not that we don't want to give him too much time. The guy's a great comedian, if nothing else. You know, he can really get a crowd laughing. And he does that through a kind of building a kind of solidarity through cruel and sadistic joking. So I wonder about that and how we move from that kind of political humor to a maybe more liberating kind of political humor.
No, absolutely. And I hear what you say. It's not that the right can't do gags, and we need to kind of recognize that, because that has been an important lubricant in their ability to build social spaces. Although, again, you know, because I'm so Pollyanna-ish, I do always wonder about one of the things you also learn from watching a Trump rally is how desperate people are to be in communion with others. And I think that that's also a lesson for us, whoever those people are. You know, people long to be in communion, long to be part of something, long to be part of a collective laughter. Yes, he triggers collective laughter often through cruelty, but not only. They know how to hold a congregation, don't they? You know, so, and that there's something kind of, you know, both a lesson and a warning in that for us, because, of course, the left has done that as well, and that our idea of collectivity is the stadium meeting. We also know the downfalls of that, while recognizing that the emotive impact of that, the effective impact, is something that perhaps is in what the response to living a denuded life is. And our movements have done that just as much as the movements of the right have done. But when I think about, I mean, I'm interested in jokes, but not all laughter is about jokes. Like laughter, when I try and think about the laughter of social reproduction, I've been trying to think about social reproduction as more than the kind of drudgy housework of having and raising children or doing the washing up. And of course, it's important to think about those things. But I don't think, I truly do not believe that human beings remake ourselves as a species only through the drudgiest parts of material remaking of the body. I just don't feel that is a persuasive way of thinking about what the remaking of humanness is. It was always there, that question within the theorization of social reproduction, as if remaking the species and remaking the work was just about giving birth and cooking dinner. Whereas everyone in the world knows that that's not how you raise babies or run your family. There's all of the other things in between, and then there's all of the other ways in which both of those components are remade far beyond the family. You know, so what is the role of being in the pub with my mates? Or what is the role of the banter my kids have with their mates on in the corridors between classes? What is the impact of sociality in the remaking of humankind? And so, again, just because I think it might be good for us in this moment to say how and when and if we laugh together is also an insight into how we are remade and we remake each other, and that there's something in our ability to laugh together, even in the most difficult of circumstances, which human beings have always done, which gives an insight about what our being together might be. You know, that's all really what I mean by laughter. So it might not be jokes always. You know, jokes might be part of it. And also, if we think of jokes as a joke, Trump says that's a certain kind of performance of the joke, isn't it? It's a pre-scripted joke that is said for a tactical reason in a certain public arena. But lots of human jokes are not like that, are they? Most of the best human jokes are just like, you rubbed up against someone in the street and we said something unexpected to each other, but it was hilarious. And we all go away with something of a shared and multi-directional energy, which buoys us through the next bit of our difficult day. Now, that energy between humans as we touch each other, and touch each other not in competition or antagonism or racialized division, but just in the possibility of laughter, I think that's worth just kind of hanging on to for a minute. I don't absolutely know how it works, as you kind of pointed out. What normally happens when I write a book is I start off thinking, I don't know this, and I'll go through all the ways I don't know it, and then I know a bit more about it. But at the end, it's like, but I don't know this other thing. The other thing I think I don't know is, okay, there's something in human association which is the kernel of what revolutionary solidarity must be. Doesn't mean we've got it yet, but it's not going to come from outside us. It can only come from us. So part of the prefiguration of that might be when we laugh together. I also just wanted to write in a book somewhere that when the masses laugh, the powerful quake. I want that, say it at my funeral. That's what I believe.
Yeah, me too. It reminded me of a really interesting essay from maybe 20 years ago now by Paolo Virno, the Italian Marxist theorist, about wit. And in it, I mean, it's been a while since I read it, so I might be hallucinating a Paolo Virno article here. But I think what's interesting is, like, this was part of the kind of autonomist attempt to figure out what it was that capital was after, ultimately. What is the living in living labor that capital must feed upon like a vampire? And he drills down, and eventually he comes to like wit, and he comes to puns, and I just think it's such an interesting. I mean, we live in a world where, of course, comedy is hyper commodified. You know, comedians. In fact, we're in allegedly a golden age of stand up comedy right now, and people have written interestingly about the work of comedy. Yes. But to set that aside, I think it's what your work and Virno's work was making me think about in this regard is just that there's, like, when we think about, after capital has taken absolutely everything, it can't take your sense of humor away. And that kind of joke, that even the gallows humor shared by workers in scenes of horrendous exploitation. Or, to think about like James Scott's work on the hidden transcript of resistance, setting aside accusations that James Scott may or may not have given information to security forces, we'll not comment on that. But in any case, it was, an interesting theory where, suggesting that even a kind of look and a smirk or even sometimes the comedy that can come from just doing things a little too early or a little too late I think there's something really beautiful there to keep our focus on in times that feel very dark. But it comes back to the question, and I wanted to come back here to the question of young people, because I think as a living fossil and a Marxist dinosaur, I don't really go on TikTok often, but whenever I do, or, you know, like a living fossil, I see things from TikTok that are shared with me on other more paleo social media platforms. I'm always incredibly impressed by the kind of wit that is being articulated also in political terms by a younger generation who have at their disposal these platform technologies, which of course have so many forms of exploitation baked into them, so many forms of attention capture and data capture and all the rest. And yet, very, very interesting things are happening. And there's something that's emerging there, I think, that speaks against the kind of fatalism. That, you know, we just have to accept the fact that capitalism is a fundamentally broken system and there's nothing we can do about it. I sense that among younger people, that might be what emerges on the surface of the discourse, that like, we hate this system, we know it's rotten, but we have no idea what to do. But there's something, it feels to me, insurgent, incipient, and imminent in the forms of humor on these platforms that seem important to me. But that's as far as my thinking has gone. What do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I also think that kind of horror in the face of global collapse is giving rise to a widespread gallows humor, which is also a gallows imagination. So I don't mean that it's a fatalism. It's an abolitionist moment. That, you know, stop messing about, you old people, trying to fix this kind of militarized vehicle which is killing you and killing us. We need to build something else, and let's laugh as we do it, and we'll speak to each other differently as we do it, and the affiliations that you have relied upon, well, it doesn't look to us like they work, so we'll remake our affiliations on the hoof. We're in the process of doing that. So I think all of that is kind of, you know, that kind of explosion of too much stuff to hear is partly that moment. It's like, you know, it feels like, you know, in some of the period that, you know, the pre-revolutionary moment where you can't walk down the street without people trying to push 25 different, slightly different pamphlets into your hand. So it's that kind of online thing that, you know, we can all see this is not it, but let's speak to each other, speak to each other, speak to each other, and speak to each other in many registers of entertainment and affinity as well, which I also think is interesting, isn't it? Because that's a difference from, we had our cell and we decided this is how we're going to save you, now read our literature and come to our meeting. Instead, not that anyone I know ever did that, but instead a kind of a model of political discourse, as you say, which is embedded in the platforms of entertainment. So you'll just come up on your phone amongst many other odd things around cats and makeup and, but it will just be all intertwined about how you feel and how you feel about each other, and you'll make, and there's something emerging. And I think it's, that's still undecided. I'm pretty certain it's not Leninism, but, you know, it's to be decided what that thing is, I guess.
You know, Lenin, I've only ever heard one joke that Lenin used to tell, and it was about Germany. Which is that there would never be a revolution in Germany because they'd go and they'd say, comrades, take the train station. They'd all go to the train station and then everyone would line up to stamp their ticket appropriately and they'd never get to the revolution because everyone would be in the lineup. As someone who lives in Germany, I won't say, yeah, I can appreciate the joke. I never heard any other one that he told, though.
I don't want to suggest Lenin knew no jokes. I just think he didn't like everyone to have a say all at once.
That's right. And there might be a joker in chief. Yeah. Commissar, people's commissar of humor. Is there anything we missed? Anything you'd like to add?
I guess the thing that I did want to say, which I hope speaks back to the broader theme of your series, is that as well as the laughter that happens from the masses and between the masses, even in the darkest of times, I would also like to make a kind of pitch for the role of playfulness and an openness to being and seeing the ridiculous as part of our political futures and imaginations. I think playfulness, of course, playfulness can always be misused, can't it? You know, if what has been commodified more than our desire to play. And as you've already said, that the kind of platform economy that we are living through absolutely colonizes our desire to play and uses it to rediscipline us as these, you know, differently emerging economic subjects. But at the same time, I think there are things about the possibility of play, certainly that you might do with many others who are not yet like you, but in the process you build affinity with through the yet kind of uncharted realm of play, which almost always must be remade on the hoof. But you can see that in new political formations, and I think we should cock that and say, yeah, you know, let's run with that. That's worth running with. And the other thing, which I've just been trying to make a pitch for in many places, that I've been raised in a left that takes itself very, very, very seriously. But the world is a terrible place, and we are the ones who know it best. And we have made our critique, and we'd like to now share our critique with you. Don't you smirk at me, because let me tell you that things are very bad and serious. And I understand why people hold that weight, but I also wonder if our ability to be open to what is puzzling about the changes and the formations we see and how our enemies arrange ourselves means that we might have to give up always being so serious about ourselves, because we might have to say things that are silly or we're not certain about, or just be open to being ridiculous to each other, because some of that needs to be tried out. And I'd really like to sell that pitch to people as a thing worth doing. And it doesn't mean people won't ever take anything you say seriously. And you know, I think it's also about that, to say, you know, to be easy with appearing or being ridiculous in moments just might be required of the most serious comrades. Because look what is before us. Anyone who says they know where we have to go next and that will, in a way that will save us all, is not being honest with themselves. So we need to find some playful and buoyant and imaginative ways to be with each other, because the world depends on it.
Weird Economies is sponsored by the Canada Council for the Arts. You can listen to the whole podcast as well as view the transcript at weirdeconomies.com.